From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. Martin Luther King is best remembered for the final few years of his life. Taylor Branch explores King's early years and the evolution of the civil rights movement in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Parting the Waters. On today's Fresh Air, Terry Gross speaks with Taylor Branch. Terry also speaks with jazz trombonist Ray Anderson. The Downbeat Critics poll picked Anderson as best trombonist 2 years running. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from bandleader, composer, and saxophonist Benny Carter. And television critic David Bianculli previews 3 new TV shows, among them the latest project from Muppet creator Jim Henson. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. Today, Terry will speak with Taylor Branch, whose book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for History. Branch says that Martin Luther King's life is the best and most important metaphor for American history in the post-war years. Branch's book is both a biography of King and a social history of the civil rights movement. Taylor Branch is a former staff member of the Washington Monthly, Harper's, and Esquire magazines. He's a white journalist, and he thinks whites have generally measured King's importance according to his impact on white society. Branch wanted to overcome the pitfalls of race by knitting together King's story with the personal stories of blacks and whites at the highest and lowest stations within the movement, along with the stories of the politicians who became the movement's enemies and allies. Branch told Terry Gross there was more that he wanted to add to the already extensive documentation of the civil rights movement.
Well, I wanted to add heart and drama, which are the two things that I found most lacking in the civil rights literature that I've been reviewing since I became a professional writer. I remembered that period myself, although I was a latecomer, as so powerful that it could change people's lives against their will. In fact, it changed my life. I was just a high school student who didn't care about politics, and the next thing I knew, the Birmingham sucked me into it and got me interested in politics. But when I started reading the literature, it seemed to me that civil rights history had degenerated into a series of morality plays or kind of set pieces that really had piety, but not the tremendous soul-wrenching and politics-changing drama that I remembered from the 1960s.
Well, your book, Parting the Waters, starts with the founding of the Black Baptist Church and then talks about the subsequent split within the church, and I think that becomes one of the themes through the book, the importance of the black church in the civil rights movement, but also the impossibility of King using the National Baptist Black Church as a national base. And I think the first place where we really see the split in King's life is between King and his own father.
Well, that's certainly true. I wanted to start, the black church is a self-contained world, and I wanted to give people a sense, because really what the amazing romantic story in the book is a rise of that isolated world that is literally invisible to white culture in 1950s to the point that it seizes a place in the national and even international stage. But the church world was King's world, and you can't understand King unless you knew what it was like to be a black Baptist minister in the 1940s. And really that opens the door to understand the relationship between himself and his father, which was tempestuous at best the entire life. Daddy King was a great prince of the church. By his own autobiography, he wanted to be a banker and have a big brick house and basically be a potentate. And there were many preachers of his generation who did precisely that. King was always haunted by it. He admired the power. He never rejected the lifestyle, the mannerisms, the careful tradecraft of the big-time preacher who entered at just the right moment and was late and that sort of thing. But he was haunted by the notion that the Cadillac-driving preachers, as he criticized his contemporaries, were really betraying the great mass of people that supported them.
I think it's interesting to point out that King's father was a Republican, voted for Richard Nixon.
Well, it's easy to forget in these days that the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, was the party of choice for most American blacks for almost a century. Franklin Roosevelt made some inroads into that during the Depression, but really prestige republicanism was prominent among blacks, and believe it or not, still is to this day, although you will find very difficult time documenting it unless you go around to some of the old conservative, prestigious black families. They're still Republicans. Martin King voted for Eisenhower in 1956, and Eisenhower carried the black vote in 1956. So this is, the civil rights movement was part of a shift in American politics that lives with us to this day and didn't automatically happen.
Martin Luther King Jr. was involved in a big feud with the head of the National Baptist Convention, J.H. Jackson.
Yes.
And he opposed King, he opposed the sit-ins of the civil rights movement, he opposed much of the civil rights movement. At one of the national conventions, King wanted to figure out whether he should whether he should publicly support Jackson's opposition or not. At that convention, there was literally a wedge of opposing black preachers who took over the stage where J.H. Jackson's people were. Could you describe that scene, what happened and what it meant?
Well, it meant a great deal. It was the scene itself was somewhat like a Teamsters convention. It was chaos. It's 10,000 ministers jammed into a giant hall in Kansas City, and it was billed as the great showdown between the civil rights forces and the conservative forces within this National Black Baptist Church, which is an organization. The significance of which is hard for most whites to appreciate because the church was so central a black institution. It's important. It was almost like the Vatican in European culture before the Reformation. This was the organization in which preachers made their names. And on this showdown day, King and the civil rights forces were coming to try to take charge of the convention And King hoped to fulfill his dream to use the organized power of a massive church to literally overwhelm segregation, to call on a certain day. His dream was that he could call on a certain day and use the power of the church to organize ministers and Baptists from all over the nation to descend on a certain place and sit in against segregation. However, at this, the church was divided, and the great J.H. Jackson, who was organized against him for political and racial reasons and a lot of other things, they were ready. There was bedlam in the hall. There literally was fighting and shoving matches. And one preacher was a Jackson supporter, was knocked off the podium and suffered a concussion and later died. J.H. Jackson won the vote that day and all but accused King of being responsible for murdering his fellow who had died and then read King out of the church so that King was excommunicated from his own national church. This was a tremendously significant event in that it meant that King lost his dream of using the organized power of the black clergy against segregation in an almost traditional way, and therefore he had to go more to personal sacrifice, going to jail and street demonstrations on its own. To me, it was also significant because not a word of all of this escaped into the white press, even though conservative whites and segregationists might well have used it very much to their advantage in saying that King and his civil rights agenda had been rejected by his own ministers.
My guest is Taylor Branch, and he's the author of the new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. You write, too, about how the Kennedys tried to use Martin Luther King in part to gain the black vote. Kennedy realized he needed the black vote to win in 1959, and his first choice of somebody to help shift the black support to Kennedy was Jackie Robinson, but he was a Republican. The second choice was Adam Clayton Powell, but he wanted a lot of money to do that. He asked for about $300,000. And then the Kennedy campaign people thought Martin Luther King would be very helpful to the campaign. When Martin Luther King was in jail once after a sit-in, John F. Kennedy called Coretta King, who was at the time pregnant, and sent his best, and she... Why don't you explain what the call was like?
Well, the call actually was the result of clandestine maneuver, really, within the Kennedy campaign, largely on the part of Sergeant Shriver, who was very much aware of the minority issues, and that was his job within the campaign. He got Senator Kennedy to call more or less as a courtesy. It caused an enormous amount of friction within the campaign after Robert Kennedy, the campaign manager, found out about it because they were terribly afraid of offending white voters in the South. And Robert Kennedy chewed them out, had a tremendous internal fight, forbade them to do anything else like that. But then Robert Kennedy, as was his habit, was always doing something mean and then feeling confessional about it, like a good Catholic, I suppose. And so he called and made his own telephone call down there to the judge, wondering why Martin Luther King was being held at 4 months hard labor for a traffic ticket. And Sergeant Shriver, then, the new part of the book, what I try to get into is how exactly it happened that they used this information, the Kennedy campaign, to win the 1960 election. It's been disclosed before that this was important. But the details that I get into are basically how the Shriver and Harris Wofford and some of the people behind the scenes in the Kennedy campaign ran a clandestine operation secret from John and Robert Kennedy themselves to publicize these incidents in pamphlets delivered within a week, almost 2 million of them, shortly before the 1960 election. And what they did was that they used the church organization that King had been building within the National Black Baptist Convention. This pamphlet, which was disseminated all over the country on Shriver's own money, secret from his own bosses, got a dramatic shift in the black vote. They shifted 40 points from 1956, and by all polls, it was not expected until that last weekend. So, in some degrees, this operation was responsible, critical sense, it was responsible for John Kennedy's election. And the great irony is that Sarge Shriver never got the credit for doing it.
Well, you describe how this group set up a dummy committee of black preachers so that it would seem as if the black preachers had printed the brochures and had distributed them to the black churches.
That's right, because the campaign and Shriver's people were terrified that if the Kennedy campaign were publicly identified as the source of these pamphlets touting basically Martin Luther King and the black races in connections with the Kennedys, that it would cause a backlash in the South among white voters, and more personally for Shriver, that it would make his brother-in-law, John Kennedy, furious with him. So he did it secretly through the church.
Could you give us some idea of what these pamphlets said?
Oh, it just said the candidate, Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, the candidate with a heart versus no comment Nixon. That's basically all it said, that Nixon didn't bother to comment on Martin Luther King's being arrested and sent to hard labor, whereas Senator Kennedy picked up the phone and made what was literally a two-minute courtesy call. Mrs. King, I'm thinking about you. I'm sorry this has happened. So on that relatively small difference, the races and the cultures were so far apart at this time that a small courtesy call like that, if was a matter that had everyone tied in knots within the campaign and could make the difference in an election if properly handled.
I think this pamphlet story and the way it was distributed within the black churches illustrates a point that you made earlier. You said that the black church was virtually invisible to white culture. And the impression I get from your book is that the reason largely why the Kennedy campaign wanted to distribute these pamphlets through the black church was that so the white press couldn't find out about it. They were afraid if the white press got the story that this would alienate white voters.
That's true. It's also true that, of course, only a couple of people in the Kennedy campaign themselves realized this. All they knew was that the church people that were connected with the Kennedys were saying, we can do this, we have ways of doing this that won't involve you. So even the people in the Kennedy campaign, of course, weren't that aware of the organization and the whole world of what was going on inside the black church. That's one reason we don't really understand, I certainly didn't before I started this research many long years ago, that this world that King grew up in, if you don't understand something about it, what it was like, you're really kidding yourself to think that you could come out of nowhere and understand what he went through, even in becoming the leader of his people, let alone in getting the movement off the ground in the white world as well as the black world.
But here you are, a white reporter, trying to tell this story and trying to understand the world as best as you could. Do you think that you were at something of a disadvantage as a white reporter trying to write a history of the civil rights movement?
Well, everybody's at a disadvantage because no matter what color you are, you're a minority. I think that a black reporter may have had some disadvantage in other parts of the story. This is about J. Edgar Hoover and John and Robert Kennedy and people of all different colors. I think that it's much larger than race, and I think that's the spirit of the whole movement. As a research matter, I didn't really encounter very much resistance once I did my reading and got educated. Most of the time, people were only black people that I interviewed were only too happy to help, because to them it was rare that anybody of any color had shown interest in the real details of what had been going on in that period.
Yeah, you say that in addition to being about Martin Luther King and leaders of the civil rights movement, the book is also about Hoover and Kennedy. And I want to talk with you a little bit about that after we take a short break. My guest is Taylor Branch, author of the new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Taylor Branch is my guest, and he's a former staff member of the Washington Monthly, Harper's, and Esquire. Let's get a little bit into the relationship between Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, and J. Edgar Hoover. It's common knowledge now that Hoover wiretapped Martin Luther King's phone and was really on his tail for quite a long time. Now, Robert Kennedy authorized the wiretap on King. Would you explain what was behind Robert Kennedy's authorization?
Well, it's very difficult to do in a short time. I should say that it was the culmination, really, of a three-year wrestling match between Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover over wiretapping in general, security, organized crime, and their entire relationship. The wiretaps were authorized in October and November of 1963, the last set only a matter of weeks before President Kennedy was assassinated. So really, the wiretaps were the outcome and at the end of basically Robert Kennedy's tenure as Attorney General and during at the end of the Kennedy administration. They had what amounted to a long chess match over King and civil rights. Kennedy wanted to get J. Edgar Hoover out of the security and politics business, the business of policing what was American and what was a security risk and that sort of thing, because he thought the FBI was vastly overdeployed in that area and was not fighting organized crime at all. Hoover resisted that ferociously because those political functions were basically what made him autonomous. He made the rules, and he was accountable to no one, and the evidence was secret. So he wanted to keep that kind of a role rather than fighting crime the way Robert Kennedy wanted him to. And they came over time to fight this battle, really, over Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, because basically Hoover was saying, here's where the security threat is. If you want to get me out of security, you've got to be saying there's no threat here, and this is something that's going to be an upheaval and a grave threat to all of America. So they fought, and it was they fought in the Freedom Rides, then they fought all through 1962, and they fought over wiretaps, and it kind of mixed the spy business into acute racial hatreds and politics, and also into fights over really almost a constitutional issue of what kind of FBI ought to be run. And that is a story that ran from start to finish through the Kennedy administration, but ultimately Robert Kennedy gave in. And I had always felt that no explanation of that had made sense before. Kennedy clearly knew that when he handed a wiretap authorization on Martin Luther King to J. Edgar Hoover, he was giving Hoover a trump card and losing a lot of his hope of controlling him. And toward the end of the book, there are several factors, including some unsavory ones that I think came into play. Hoover was protecting Robert Kennedy against the public knowledge or possibility that public knowledge might emerge that President Kennedy had been involved in a sex scandal with an East German woman that Hoover thought was a spy. So you even have some of these more salacious tabloid-type Kennedy sex stories that we've seen lately at that time coming into play into this twisted wrestling match between the Kennedys and Hoover over King and the fate of the civil rights movement.
See, there's really an element of blackmail in there.
Well, I think basically so. Hoover was too smart. He was a genius as a bureaucrat. He's not going to go in there and say, Mr. President, I'm saving you, or Mr. Attorney General, I'm saving the president's neck here on this sex scandal. He's done it again. And if you don't give me the wiretap, I'm going to blow the whistle. He would never do that, but he would go in. And in fact, some of the documents are the same. The King documents and the sex scandal documents are two different files, but they're the same conversations, which was a great discovery for me in my research. He would go in and say, I'm very concerned. The FBI is very concerned. We found out this information about the president. We desperately want to help. And by the way, we're having this trouble over here with King, and that even though he's just delivered the I Have a Dream speech and has shaken America and waked it up and is very popular, I, J. Edgar Hoover, still consider him the prime security threat, and won't you help me out? So it was done in a kind of a courtly, polite way, but everybody who was involved on the inside knew what the nature of the game was, and it was a, and indeed it did turn out to be true that once Kennedy gave in and signed that wiretap authorization, he literally lost control over Hoover. He was signing more wiretaps within a matter of days, and then, of course, the assassination happened, and it fell away altogether.
I want to read one of the last sentences, well, actually the two last sentences that you close your book with. You write, King, this is, by the way, after Kennedy's assassination and after the March on Washington, and you write, King has crossed over as a patriarch like Moses into a land less bounded by race. To keep going, he became a pillar of fire. Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Well, what I'm saying is that you know, the title of this book is Parting the Waters, and I'm working on a sequel about the Johnson years entitled Pillar of Fire. What I'm, these are both from the book of Exodus, the story of, and black culture, black church culture and political culture are heavily influenced by Hebrew history, and which is why I take both of my titles out of Exodus. Pillar of Fire refers to the and, of course, the symbolism here is just as the Hebrews passed over out of slavery from Egypt and thought they were going into the Promised Land, so too did the blacks several times, and in this case during the Civil Rights Movement. But instead of going directly into the Promised Land, both of them went into the wilderness period, an in-between period that was difficult. And for the Hebrews, according to the book of Exodus, they were guided at night by a pillar of fire that appeared before them. And what I'm suggesting by way of metaphor here for the second book, which is what I'm working on now, is that King literally consumed himself during the period when he went from Nobel Peace Prize winner and someone whose reputation stood high in the entire world, which was a miracle in itself, a great story. But then he became popular. He became rejected by all sides, including the black militants, the white militants, and he got consumed by Vietnam, by blackmail, by the threats over the revelations about his own private life. And this really is King's epiphany, the period when he was a pillar of fire in the sense that he was consumed by his own internal passions. And the greatness of King was that they drove him back down to Memphis, where he died among garbage workers, and that is a real, almost religious epiphany for him during that period to have lit up the world, even though his own life was in such a crucible of destruction.
I have to assume that you've been changed by the experience of researching and writing the book, and I'd like to know what assumptions you had were challenged by the research that you did, by the new things that you learned.
Well, an awful lot of them. I didn't realize that it would take, in effect, learning at least the beginnings of a new language to understand the culture that King grew up in. And I feel stupid for that, because if the Civil Rights Movement didn't taught us one thing, it was that the races were pretty far apart and didn't understand each other, and yet we tended to think that because we passed the Civil Rights Bill, well, gosh, we know everything we need to know, and we're now fully educated, and that wasn't true. I think the biggest thing, though, was to realize, for me, as far as King is concerned, how much pressure he was under from within his own world, and how much of him was defined by his relationship with the students. In many parts of this story, the students are ahead of King, and he knows it, and he's the first to pay tribute to him, and he's in turmoil over it. And when you realize what a he was as a young man, he was kind of a pedant. He was a sweethearted aristocrat. And when you realize how royal and how princely his early life was within his own culture, I respect all the more what he gave up and what he risked to lead a movement that would go to jail, in Birmingham in particular, when the whole movement was literally about to go down the tubes, to make the decision to send second and third graders by the hundreds into jail in Birmingham, which is a rough town, is an unbelievable decision. And now that I have children, I can appreciate that, but I can't really appreciate what it would have been like to be a black person in Birmingham doing that in 1963. This is a truly, religiously and morally and politically, it is a great upheaval, and it moved me deeply to be to get as close to it as I could in researching this book.
Yeah, you point out that in many ways the students were ahead of King in terms of being willing to go to jail and realizing that the power they would have, the power that they would get in going to jail for acts of civil disobedience. King was for a while reluctant to align himself with the sit-ins, knowing that everyone would be arrested. Why was he initially reluctant?
Well, part of that was because he was a preacher, and he hoped to convert. Preachers are evangelists, and they hope to preach. Segregation is wrong. Racial justice is vital in the world. The world is too small for this kind of prejudice. And King knew all the lines, and he was a genius at preaching. And as an orator alone, he may be the last great classical orator of this century. So with some good reason, he hoped not to have to go to jail. I mean, the preacher's way of doing it is to find a big enough audience, convert people, have them turn away, and change, which is why he was trying to take over his own church to do that, and it was why he was trying to make an alliance with Billy Graham in the 1950s, who was one of his friends. So for him, the notion that oratory alone and that truth wouldn't work and that America would cling to segregation in spite of the truth that he was preaching was very difficult for him to. I mean, it was like an admission that his profession was a failure or could not work or was ineffective. And the students taught him that sacrifice and drama and going to jail and that sort of thing have greater potency in the world than truth alone and the spoken word. And that was hard for him to admit. Plus the fact that when you grow up with all of his privileges and the acute awareness that middle class status for blacks is not as secure as it is, we tend to assume for whites that once you're middle class and secure, you're going to stay that way. For blacks, it'd been a long, hard sweat over many generations, and they were acutely aware that with one slip or going to jail or some blot on their record, they could slide back down into the underclass. So both because he wanted so desperately for the ministry to work and because he was personally afraid for the consequences of what would happen, he knew that the road of sacrifice pointed toward not just jail and being beaten and that sort of thing, but for somebody of his stature and his visibility, the possibility of martyrdom. And he spoke about that his entire career.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Taylor Branch's book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, is published by Simon & Schuster. It just won the Pulitzer Prize for History. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross's guest will be singer and artist Yoko Ono. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. Jazz trombonist Ray Anderson prides himself on playing sounds, not just notes. Those sounds have led Downbeat magazine to name Anderson best at his instrument 2 years running. Coming up, we meet Ray Anderson. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Benny Carter album. Carter's been playing the saxophone since the 20s. Kevin says his album shows Carter at the top of his form. And television critic David Bianculli has an advanced look at 3 new shows on NBC. He offers an educated guess at their chances for survival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. Federal Drug Chief William Bennett today announced a new plan aimed at combating the rising tide of drug-related violence in the nation's capital. More than 130 people have been killed in the District of Columbia this year alone. Many of those killings were drug-related. Bennett's wide-ranging plan calls for federal intervention and assistance, including expanded prison space, a stronger anti-drug strike force, and measures to crack down on drug dealing in public housing projects. In a press conference this morning, Bennett was critical of the efforts by the District of Columbia government to stem the violence, but he said officials in the district must be a part of the anti-drug effort.
It's clear that the city government has to cooperate. Again, they must cooperate. This is not an attempt to get the D.C. government off the hook. They must go to work now seriously and meet their responsibilities.
Bennett says his plan will cost $70 to $80 million. Funding will come from shifting previously approved funds from other areas. 4 defendants were convicted today for the second largest cash robbery in U.S. history. A fifth defendant was acquitted in the 1983 heist of $7.1 million from a Wells Fargo armored car in Hartford, Connecticut. The money was allegedly used to fund a militant group seeking the independence of Puerto Rico. The defendants had argued that they were victims of mistaken identity. They also complained that they were tried by the government because of their open support for Puerto Rican independence and peaceful activities by militant independence activists. 9 other defendants still await trial in the case. A twin-engine aircraft carrying a missionary group from Haiti to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, was hijacked today. The plane was diverted to Miami, where it touched down at 2:30 Eastern Time this afternoon. A spokesman for the airplane's owner, the Missionary Aviation Fellowship of California, said 2 gunmen have surrendered and the passengers are safe. The FBI, however, has not confirmed any arrests. The fellowship is an international Christian aviation group that operates 145 planes in lesser-developed countries. Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze is visiting Soviet Georgia in an attempt to help calm tensions there. At least 17 people died when troops attacked Georgian demonstrators over the weekend. The demonstrators want autonomy for the republic. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports from Moscow.
The fact that Mr. Shevardnadze has called off his trip to East Berlin, where he was due to attend a meeting of the Warsaw Pact, is evidence of how seriously the authorities regard the trouble in Georgia. Mr. Shevardnadze used to be the Communist Party chief in his native republic, and he's said to have gone there to try to restore the situation to normal and to calm the passions. The foreign ministry spokesman, Mr. Gennady Gerasimov, said Mr. Shevardnadze was in Georgia to represent the party leadership. Mr. Gerasimov claimed that Tbilisi was currently tense but mostly calm, and he said the majority of the population had been working normally despite a call for a general strike. However, local people said that no buses had been running in the city and that some factories were closed. Mr. Gerasimov also denied reports that soldiers had fired into the air to disperse protesters, as eyewitnesses had claimed, and he sharply attacked the nationalist demonstrators, describing them as political adventurers who were abusing democracy and glasnost.
Diana Goodman in Moscow. Oliver North testified today that President Reagan telephoned him the day he was fired from his White House job and told him, quote, "Thank you for all your work." The former National Security Council aide took the witness stand for a third day today in his 8-week-old Iran-Contra trial. North also testified that he never believed any of the secret work he did for the Nicaraguan rebels or for the freedom of American hostages in Lebanon was illegal. The oil slick off the coast of Alaska slowed today in its movement toward the nation's number one fishing port and is breaking up in rough waves and high winds. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 3 points to close at 2301.87. Advances led declines on a light volume. I'm Michael Richards.
This is Fresh Air. Starting in the 1920s, composer, arranger, and saxophonist Benny Carter has been a major influence on the evolution of the jazz saxophone. But the 3 decades he spent working in Hollywood studios eclipsed his reputation. In the last 10 years, Carter's been the subject of a full-length biography, has received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and has made records for several labels. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, even now, Carter's rarely is out front as he should be.
Alto saxophonist Benny Carter is one of the jazz world's most reluctant virtuosi. He's been hailed as one of our greatest alto players for 60 years, but his modern records almost always leave you hungry for more horn. Take, for example, a pair of albums from 1987. A Carter retrospective with the American Jazz Orchestra showcased his fine writing more than his playing. On a cooperative date with the flashy pianist Oscar Peterson, Carter kept letting Peterson steal the show. Benny Carter's new album, My Kind of Trouble, on the Pablo label, is a bluesy straight-ahead session that gives him little place to hide. He has no choice but to show why, at age 81, he has the most sumptuous sound of any living alto player. Listen to him on Don Redman's Gee Baby, Ain't I Good to You, which Carter first recorded in 1929. Benny Carter's companions on his new album include organist Art Hillary and guitarist Joe Pass. The altoist really struts his stuff on his blues, Berkeley Bounce. His singing attack reminds us that great jazz horn work is never far from the sound of the human voice. Carter develops his solo like a master improviser, but uses slurs and whispered notes for emphasis, the way a blues vocalist would. Benny Carter is typically generous about sharing solo room with his colleagues. I suspect the decades he spent playing anonymously in Hollywood studios made him determined to give every good improviser a break. There's some excellent work here by guitarist Joe Pass, who plays with more fire and grit than he usually does. Listen to the way his solo on the same piece takes off from the 2 softly honked notes with which Carter ends his solo. This stripped-down setting brings out the best in the rhythm section, too. Andy Simpkins is the bassist, and Ronnie Bedford is on drums. In recent years, discussion of Benny Carter has centered on his illustrious past and the quality of his compositions. But the best Benny Carter of all is Carter the saxophonist, and these days he's playing as well as, if not better than, ever. Whenever this too modest giant can be induced to blow his own horn, it's a cause for celebration.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Benny Carter's new album, My Kind of Trouble, on the Pablo label. This is Fresh Air. Critic Gary Giddens of The Village Voice called Ray Anderson one of the most compellingly original trombonists of the past decade. Anderson was voted best trombonist of 1988 in the Downbeat Critics poll. He tied for first in 1987. He's played and recorded with musicians such as Carla Bley, Anthony Davis, Gil Evans, Charlie Hayden, and Anthony Braxton. Terry Gross talked with Ray Anderson last December. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to an excerpt from the title track of Anderson's latest album, Blues Bred in the Bone.
Did you always play with growls and smears?
Yes, I suppose I always did. I started off listening to Dixieland music, so it was always apparent to me that that was something you could do with a trombone. I don't know exactly, you know, what I sounded like many years ago, but I suppose I always had that in the lexicon somewhere.
But when you were first playing trombone in the 50s and 60s, the kind of jazz that was current at the time was bop, and I don't think that bop trombonists really used those colors in their playing.
That's true. And for that reason, I always felt a great frustration with the bop language scene. It always appeared to me that even the very best of the bop trombonists, like J.J. and Curtis Fuller and these other really magnificent players, were still somehow a step behind the trumpet and saxophone, just in the fluency and the ease with which they could dash off those kind of bop language phrase things. So I was always looking for something else to do, and in that sense, the Ellington tradition or the Dixieland tradition, as carried on by, say, Roswell Rudd, was very important to me as soon as I was getting any awareness at all of, like, you know, what to do with music or try and develop a style, and, you know, was moving beyond just playing in between baseball games or something, you know.
Do you use mutes a lot, and if so, what kinds do you like to use?
Actually, the only mute I like is plunger.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also have a little trumpet mute that I put inside the trombone on occasion and then use the plunger over that. That's the Tricky Sam legacy. That's like you get that sort of Tricky Sam sound from that.
And Tricky Sam Natten was one of the trombonists in the Ellington band.
Yes, right. The real, you know, Tricky Sam and Bob Remiley are really the inventors of plunger. Period from the Ellington band, and some of the stuff they did is still like the most unbelievable sound. So it remains a powerful inspiration for those of us that fool with the plunger.
When you're using a plunger mute, do you make it out of a plunger, or do you go to a music shop and buy a plunger mute?
No, it's a plunger. And a problem is that I find the old plungers, which were made out of very hard rubber, have a better sound than the ones you can buy nowadays, which are very soft and pliant. So this has become a kind of problem. It's like how to find an old plunger. You know, I have a fairly old one and would like to find yet an older one. Maybe if somebody has one, they could mail it into the station or something.
One of the things I really like about your playing is your playing really has a sense of humor to it. And I think that's especially evident on your interpretation of Mona Lisa. I think the arrangement's great. It has all these clashing international styles, reggae, cha-cha.
Yeah, it's the Andersonorious dance groove, whatever that is.
Up in Chicago.
Yes.
And when you started playing trombone in school, you played with George Lewis, who's now a new music and jazz trombonist too.
Mm-hmm.
Did you realize when you were playing together when you were kids that you would both end up remaining serious about the instrument?
No, not at all. I don't think either one of us had any inkling that we would still be at it all these years later.
What made you realize that you were serious?
Actually, I stopped playing when I got out of high school and I was 16, and all I knew really was that I hated school. I always hated school. And so my parents were kind enough to say, well, okay, so don't go on to college right away. You know, so they set up this thing where I went to Europe at that age and sort of bummed around for a year. I had a bunch of contacts of friends of theirs and, you know, just traveled around. And I went extremely lightly. I didn't take a trombone. I took a soprano saxophone, a small one, which would jam in my backpack. and a couple recorders and went off on this year and gradually realized that I could not exist without playing. And it became about, you know, jam sessions in these youth hostels and with whatever guitar player you could find and whatever. And my little arsenal of instruments kept growing. Pretty soon I had soprano, three recorders, one half of a tabla drum set. You know, it was like, so I sort of discovered at that point that how important that really was to me. I had been doing it in high school, but didn't realize that it was so central to my whole being. As, you know, it's like when I stopped, then I realized I couldn't stop.
On your new record, you have a lot of, you know, you have four interesting musicians with you. It's not a working band, though. This is not a band that you keep on salary and tour with and perform with. You brought these guys together for the record. Is that right?
Right.
Is it hard to keep together a working band? Has it been hard for you to... Is that something you'd like to do but haven't been able to do?
Exactly. That is something that I really look forward to being able to do and at the moment cannot do. You know, I have work and then I have long periods without work, you know. I just went to Europe for about 3.5 weeks, and it's great what happens to a band, you know, when you have, like, work every night for that kind of period of time. But now, you know, I don't actually know when my next period of concentrated work will be. So I have to hire who's available at what time, and there hasn't been a great deal of consistency of personnel. In a way, that's also fine because I'm sort of still beginning as a band leader, and it's nice to be able to try out different people. But I look forward to the day when there's enough work to be able to say, okay, you know, this is the band here, you know, make a commitment to this because there's enough work that you could make a commitment to it, you know.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you. It's really fun.
Ray Anderson's most recent recording, Blues Bred in the Bone, is on the Gramavision label. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up next. Co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. What do you have for us, Robert?
Hi, Marty. We have stories about the violence in Soviet Georgia. Also a report by Rene Montaigne about the practice of prosecutors using RICO. You know, RICO is the racketeering statute. It's intended for prosecuting organized criminals, but it's now been applied to some right-to-life groups. We'll also be hearing about a disturbing practice in Salt Lake City where teenagers have taken to drinking some cough medicine, you know, to get high. And a couple of kids have actually died from drinking, in that case, Robitussin.
Okay, those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The television networks have only a few weeks left before they decide what programs they're going to put in their fall lineups. So they're offering some new shows now to see what works. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of three programs premiering this week on NBC.
The first new NBC series is called Nearly Departed. It's a sitcom about married ghosts who watch in horror as a tacky family moves into their old home. Eric Idle of Monty Python's Flying Circus plays one of the ghosts, and he's invisible to everyone, except to Grandpa Garrett, who notices him and his ghostly wife right away.
Grant, he can see us.
That's impossible. How can you see us? We're dead.
Big deal. I'm 75 and don't feel so good myself.
Sounds like Beetlejuice? It is, but only if you take away that movie's wit, intelligence, and special effects. If you're looking for a cozy little remake of Topper, forget it. Next, on Thursdays, comes Dream Street. It's the new series from Edward Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz, the creators of 30-something, but this show is different, kind of. Its characters are mostly 20-something, and they live in New Jersey, and most of them are working class. Dennis, the hero, works for his dad's refrigeration company, and when he calls up a schoolteacher to ask her out, he wears his blue collar like a badge of honor.
Maybe it would embarrass you to go out with a guy like me? No yuppie clothes, no fancy diploma.
Well, wait a minute, that's not it at all.
Let's face it. Some people, they just look down their nose at anybody that works with his hands.
7:30.
Dinner?
That's right. And whatever you do to Bo, don't wash those hands.
Other parts of Dream Street are a little less obvious, and it's got some interesting characters. If you can get past the fact that everybody dresses like either James Dean or Madonna, and if there's even more rock music than on Miami Vice, it might even be enjoyable. Now comes the big home run hit, Friday night's premiere of the Jim Henson Hour. Each hour is divided into two halves. In the first half, Kermit the Frog runs a show called Muppet Television. In the premiere, his robot assistant, Digit, finds a way to tap into TV shows from outer space.
Amazing news! I'm picking up TV signals from deep space.
What?
Yes, alien beings are transmitting TV programs not unlike our own.
But that would prove that there's intelligent life in other galaxies.
No, it just proves they have television.
It's like The Muppet Show, where Kermit was stage manager of a Muppet-filled theater company, only it uses television. And it's just as wild and wonderful as The Muppet Show was. My favorite parts of the pilot are when Louis Anderson guest stars in a movie spoof called My Dinner with Godzilla, when a very spacey group of aliens sings Neutron Dance, and when Digit the Robot gets overloaded with TV information and comes down with the reruns. As usual with Jim Henson and the Muppets, not all the jokes are for kids. Listen to Digit rerun off at the mouth.
Today's show was brought to you by the letter Friday, Joe Friday, with more precipitation Saturday morning. And you are no Jack Kennedy.
I love it. I also love the second half of the premiere show. It's a new episode of Henson's The Storyteller, which NBC has been showing as a series of specials. This week, John Hurt tells the story of the Heartless Giant, and the special effects are as good as the story. So here's the advice for this week. Reject Nearly Departed. Inspect Dream Street. And, if you've got a VCR, collect the Jim Henson Hour. Somehow, Henson and Kermit have done it again.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Well, at least we've got an opening number. And here they are, the extremes.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Over the last few years, the New York performance scene has brought out stars like Spalding Gray, Eric Bogosian, and Laurie Anderson. Next time, Terry Gross talks with the latest product of that genre, monologuist David Cale. And rock historian Ed Ward takes a serious look at some of rock's most frivolous music, bubblegum. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Fred Landrell. Production assistants from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Terry Gross will be back tomorrow. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.